It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, with the Iowa 2016 legislative session only weeks away, later this hour, political scientist Chris Larimer and IPR's State House correspondent Joyce Russell will join us to tell us what's in store from Iowa lawmakers in terms of a whole host of issues, education funding, income tax reform, budget issues, of course. But first, we want to examine a facet of our Iowa politics that sets us apart from other states. No, it's not the Iowa caucuses. It's this. Since 1969, governors of Iowa have averaged a decade in office, and that's significantly longer than governors in other states. That prompts the question, why? That's a question at the heart of the new book by Chris Larimer, Gubernatorial Stability in Iowa, A Stranglehold on Power, the title of his latest book. He is Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. And of course, one of our regular Wednesday analysts for Politics Wednesday. He joins us on this Monday, Chris Larimer. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me, Ben.
So we in Iowa, if we only live in Iowa and we are not used to looking to other states, we're used to having governors in office a long time, and it might not strike us as something that's odd. But if we compare ourselves to other states, it is different?
Absolutely, it is different. You know, as you mentioned, since 1969, you know, Iowa, the average length in office for an Iowa governor is 10 years. And as you said, that is statistically different than for other states. You know, there are 14 states that do not limit the number of terms a governor can serve in office. And even among those states, Iowa sticks out. The average for those other 13 states is about 6 years in office. Iowans, for a number of reasons, seem to like their governors as long as they're doing certain things and keep them around for multiple terms that for a length that is, you know, very different from their peers.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's get into some of those expectations, some of those reasons that we have for keeping our governors around, or in one case, as you point out in your book, for not reelecting the governor.
Right. What
are the factors you looked at? How did you approach investigating Iowa as an anomaly for a length of office?
Yeah, well, let me first off say that the funding for this project was provided by a grant from the Center on the American Governors at Rutgers University, as well as the Department of Political Science here at UNI. And the approach was to look at three different things. Look at how political scientists typically model approval of governors, because, you know, if you have a high approval rating, you're more likely to be reelected. So starting off with just looking at basic approval models that have been modeled in political science. And then from there, go beyond it and look at what do various politicos around the state think about Iowa governors, including reporters, as well as interviews with a couple of former governors, as far as what they see as working or doesn't work for Iowa governors. And then the last part of it was a statewide survey sent to 1,500 randomly selected Iowans throughout the state, asking them to compare the records of previous governors, such as Governor Ray, Governor Branstad's first 16 years, Governor Vilsack and Governor Culver. So it was really kind of a multi-method approach, looking at three different facets of what could potentially explain why Iowa is an anomaly in terms of how long governors stay in office.
Okay, so what are the factors you found most critical to longevity?
Well, at a very general level, I think two things. One is accessibility or visibility, however you want to frame it. There is the expectations among Iowans that you have to be out there on a regular basis. Things like the full Grassley, as Jason Noble from the Des Moines Register has coined the 99-county tour, that type of an event or those type of events are important, and Iowans seem to expect that from their governor. The second explanation is strength of the challenger. We know we've had Governor Ray in office for 14 years. We had Governor Branstad for 16 years, and then, of course, Governor Branstad is back now. Part of the explanation there, I think, is related to the strength of the challenger. We talk about that in political science terms, in terms of the challenger, the amount of political experience that they have. In Iowa, when Governors Ray, Governor Branstad, and even Governor Vilsack have gone up for reelection, in terms of elected experience of the challenger, it's actually been quite low most of the time. And so that's, I think, helped those governors run when they run for reelection. So you may have a case where maybe the economy is not trending in the right direction, but if the challenger is not particularly strong in terms of their prior experience and the perception is there that that governor has been out there on a regular basis, is accessible, is visible, even if Iowans don't take advantage of it, then they have a little bit more leeway at the polls as compared to someone who doesn't have those two things going for them.
Mm-hmm. There's a term you use in the book, Iowa comfort. What do you mean by that?
That's related to the accessibility, visibility part of it. That, you know, when I did the, when I was talking to doing the interviews through with various folks around the state, a couple of factors stuck out. One is that there has to be the personal connection. 95% of the respondents expected a personal connection. 78% said they, when they look at Iowa governors, the successful ones are those that are working hard. And also, you know, 68% of the interviewees mentioned something related to the full Grassley. I think those three things you can kind of combine together into the sense of Iowa comfort, that if you are, if the perception is that you're working hard, if the perception is that you're out there on a regular basis, you're willing to go to small meetings, you are perceived as being accessible, I think that those three things feed into the sense of Iowa comfort, where so that if Iowa voters feel comfortable with you, even though they may not see the state is going in the right direction, even though the economy may not be going in the right direction, the state's unemployment rate may be increasing marginally, you still have a little bit more leeway at the polls compared to a governor who does not do those things. So if you have that Iowa comfort, it's to your benefit as an incumbent running for reelection.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned personal. We want to have a personal connection, familiarity with our governors. We want to see them working hard. We want to have them get out and see us and interact with us. I wonder why this is, I assume, less the case in other states, that those priorities are not as highly rated in other states?
Well, that's the question that I don't have an answer to at this point. I think, but I will say this, I think Iowa's political geography lends itself to that personal connection. I think, you know, you have a state that's relatively easy to get around. You have something like the 99 county tour that's basically become an institution, starting with Senator Grassley. And, you know, I did interview Senator Grassley for the book, and he mentioned that he initially just started doing that so people wouldn't forget about him. You know, and at this point, it's not only expected of Senator Grassley, it's expected of governors, it's also expected of presidential candidates. So I think, you know, with the Iowa caucuses and what Governor Branstad has been doing, what Governor Vilsack did with the walks across Iowa, I think those two things sort of feed off of each other. So now it's to the point where if Iowans can see someone running for president of the United States up close and virtually whenever they want to, they absolutely expect to be able to do that with someone who's running for governor. Mm. And so that personal connection is there. And I think, like I said, I think the political geography and of Iowa lends itself to that with the 99 counties, with so many small towns in Iowa. You know, we have 948 towns and cities in Iowa. Over 900 of those are have a population of less than 10,000. So I think that personal connection is extremely important. And now that it's been built into the Iowa caucuses, it bleeds over into races for any race for statewide office, including the governor.
It may be necessary, but it's not all you need. If, for instance, if we could what you just said brings to mind the experience of Rick Santorum in 2012. He did the full Grassley, 99 counties, and very late had a surge in popularity and ended up winning, though we didn't know that until very after the Iowa caucuses, several days. This time he is doing the same, but without the same surge to his dislike.
That's right. There are obviously other contextual factors that matter. But, you know, what's interesting about Santorum is that he did that in 2012 or 2011. He did that at a very deliberate pace, took his time doing the 99 county tour, and it was, I think, it really to his benefit. Chris Silizia, who writes for the Washington Post, also contrasted Santorum's 99 county tour with Michelle Bachmann's 99 county tour. Mm-hmm. She did it at what he called a breakneck pace, where she really was doing, you know, 10, 15 events a day in various counties. And I don't think that appeals to Iowans. If you're just kind of rushing through that process, even though something like the 99 county tour is very symbolic, you have to do it in a way that
is heartfelt.
Yeah, exactly.
You have to perhaps mean it, and have a piece of homemade pie in every county.
Yeah, exactly.
Who knows? If you have questions about this fascinating topic, Chris Larimer, our guest, his new book, Gubernatorial Stability in Iowa, A Stranglehold on Power, trying to dissect, he has in this book, to look at why our governors serve longer than other governors in office in general terms. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Let me ask you about specific governors in the time range that you lay out in this book. Robert Ray, 1969 to 1983. Then we have the first Branstad administrations going from 83 to 99. Then we have Vilsack, 99 to 2007. And then we have Culver, 2007 to 2011. Back to Branstad, to the present. Let's take the anomaly to see what lessons you draw from that. In 2006, Chet Culver beat Jim Nussle, Congressman Nussle, by 10 percentage points. This was an easy victory in any estimation. Then, 4 years later, lost to a return of Branstad in 2010 by roughly the same margin, almost 10 points, percentage points. Tell us that story. What swept him into power, and then what happened to sweep him out?
Well, I think in 2006, you know, at face value, the matchup between Chet Culver, who was a member of the executive branch, versus Congressman Nussle, a Republican from eastern Iowa, would seem to be a pretty tough matchup. But, you know, 2006 was very much a big year for Democrats. There was a Democratic wave sweeping the country that would carry through to 2008. And I think Culver benefited from that. And that's in part why he was able to win in 2006. He did have name recognition stemming from his father serving, representing Iowa in the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate. And it was a big Democratic year. So I think that in part explains why Chet Culver did well in 2006. And he was a good, by most accounts, he was a good campaigner in 2006. I think you fast forward to 2010, and one of the key questions for this book was trying to figure out if Culver had done something differently, or if he was perceived differently, could he have won? Because there were a number of things in the atmosphere of the election that were working against him. One, the economy obviously was not doing well in 2010. We were in the middle of the Great Recession. And I should point out that the economy in Iowa does matter in terms of affecting the approval of Iowa governors. But it's not the only significant factor, and the personal things that we were talking about initially are part of that explanation. But the economy does matter. So, you know, he had a bad economy working against him. He had the rise of the Tea Party movement in 2010. There was backlash from the Varnum v. Bryan same-sex marriage ruling in Iowa, even though that was something that was decided by the Iowa Supreme Court. The governor's office had nothing to do with that. And, you know, it was a Republican year, and it was a midterm election where you had relatively low turnout, and Republicans typically do well in those midterm elections, or do better than they do in presidential elections. And the big factor here is that in 2010, we had the first ever gubernatorial election in which an incumbent was going up against a former incumbent governor. And so, you know, you had the economy working against him, which is traditionally what political science research says is kind of one of the driving factors of the popularity of a governor. And you had an extremely strong challenger in Governor Branstad, one that's unprecedented in Iowa history. And as some of the interviews and the results from the survey done for the book suggest, the perception was there that Culver was different in terms of being his personal connection as compared to his predecessors in Tom Vilsack and Terry Branstad. The perception, now he may have been as accessible, but the perception that I got from the survey and from talking to folks around the state was that he did not. The perception was there that he had a different style of governing that wasn't as appealing as his two predecessors. And even, you know, the Des Moines Register did a number of stories talking about the number of public events that Culver held compared to Vilsack and Branstad in the year going up, in the year prior to their reelection, and he had significantly fewer events. So I think if you're not out there as often, I think that can detract from your popularity, and that can detract from the amount of leeway that maybe voters are willing to give you when times are tough.
And perhaps there a note, correct me if I'm wrong, that perhaps some Iowans, I don't know if you detected this in your questioning, sensed perhaps because of the Culver name, because of his father, we don't like a sense of entitlement, perhaps?
You know, I don't know if that was necessarily the case. I think I think one other thing that actually works against him, which is maybe contrary to what you might think, is that he had unified control his entire 4 years in office. That is, the Iowa House and the Iowa Senate were both controlled by Democrats. Mm-hmm. But what we know from political science is that actually unified control in terms of your popularity is actually a bad thing, because what it does is it allows voters to direct their blame at a single person, right? If we have unified control of state government, well, the chief executive should be in charge, so we can anything that's going wrong, we can blame the chief executive.
You cannot spin your way out of it.
Exactly. And, you know, in talking to Governors Branstad and Vilsack and others, they actually mentioned the benefit of having either divided government or a split legislature like we have now, where you can allow the extremes of either party to sort of play off one another. So I think that also potentially hurt Culver once things started to turn bad, is that, you know, voters could look to the chief executive office and you couldn't play it off in terms of party politics.
Mm-hmm. Jeff from Iowa City writes and asks, why you stop at 1969? He goes back to Senator Clark, also Governor Harold Hughes. He thinks both those fit the model as well.
I think they do. It was really actually going back to when Governor Irby was not reelected in 1962. He was the, you know, you have to go from 1962 to 2010 to find the last two incumbent governors to lose. And so it does start really with Harold Hughes winning in 1962. And then Harold Hughes goes off to the United States Senate after 3 2-year terms at the time. And, you know, I think Governor Ray just kind of provided a nice break point. But even if you shift it back to 1963 with Harold Hughes, Iowa still sticks out a little bit. You have a 15-day term in there of Robert Fulton finishing Harold Hughes's term, but Iowa still sticks out. So I think you can go back almost to Harold Hughes. I mean, Harold Hughes kind of set the new precedent for Iowa governors not to serve just 2 2-year terms, and then Governor Ray really took off with it.
You say Iowa only one of 14 states without term limits. Yeah. I wonder, in your recollection, has Iowa ever considered term limits for its governors?
I think it's one of those bills that is occasionally introduced early on in legislative sessions when you're kind of throwing everything into the bank at that point. But, you know, there really hasn't been a push for it. And that was actually one of the questions I had for some of the folks I was interviewing was, if Governor Branstad, I was doing this research in 2013, if he would be reelected in 2014, would there be a push for term limits? And most people said no. You know, they felt that voters were the term limits, that Iowans seemed to be comfortable with them. You know, we have the record. It's of Tom Harkin, Neil Smith, Charles Grassley, and, you know, Jim Leach and others who have served for a long period of time. And if there is that level of comfort there, I don't know that Iowans really want to do term limits.
Mm-hmm. It was, of course, this month that Governor Branstad became the longest serving governor in U.S. history. He's been at the helm of Iowa total of nearly 21 years, passing a previous record held by a 18th century New York governor, George Clinton. He is in his sixth 4-year term. I wonder, because your book doesn't look at policies per se, you look at management style, more or less, right?
Right.
That if we could say Governor Branstad, let's imagine him as a governor of the other party, perhaps a middle center, a centrist Democrat. Could a Democrat have easily have held that much time in Iowa's governorship?
I think so. I think the test case would have been if Governor Vilsack would have run for reelection in 2006 for a third term. You know, his approval ratings were in the high 60s, low 70s. I think, and obviously it was a Democratic year in 2006. But, you know, I think by any estimation, he would have won his reelection to a third term quite easily, which would have put him in office for 12 years. And then it would have been a real interesting test in 2010 if you would have had a 12-year incumbent. Would Terry Branstad have come out of retirement to run against a Tom Vilsack in 2010? Because it was clear from the survey that Democratic voters liked the governing style of Tom Vilsack. He's a very different governor than Governor Branstad, much more of a policy wonk, I would say, than Governor Branstad. But that would have been the test. And if he would have, you know, made it through 2010, then, well, maybe he's on to, you know, 16 years or more. And so I think that that is a possibility. I don't think it was necessarily related to political party.
Mm-hmm. So it was the Republican, Iowa Republican Party and Terry Branstad that sensed that weakness in Chet Culver to come out of his other work to run again for governor. And perhaps he would have seen, you're saying, Vilsack as such a formidable candidate that he would have stayed put?
I think he would have been perceived as a more formidable candidate, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested in your subtitle here, your book, Gubernatorial Stability in Iowa, A Stranglehold on Power. Stranglehold, definite negative connotations. Why did you choose that word, and what do you mean by it?
I think it's just and I don't mean it in the negative. I guess, there's a negative connotation there, but I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing. I think it's more the stranglehold that both voters and Iowa governors seem to recognize in terms of what they want out of the governor and someone running for governor. The stranglehold on power, you know, in some ways is a positive because it's a measure of saying Iowa governors know what Iowa voters want and expect out of their chief executive, and they want that accessibility. They want that work ethic that they've come to expect from gubernatorial candidates, from presidential candidates, and they're willing to do those things. And if they do that, then Iowa voters are going to reelect them. And if they don't, then, you know, they are willing to vote them out of office. So I think it's a more reciprocal relationship between governors and voters than the negative connotation necessarily.
Mm-hmm. So you touched on this earlier, but go into it. We have a minute or so left here. So when we look at the reasons we keep governors around, mm-hmm. Certainly presidential candidates want to know the lessons. And if you would say, based on the research I've done and these surveys here are the lessons for presidential candidates.
I think it's, you know, what many of them are doing is be approachable, be visible, be accessible. You know, one of the things I mentioned toward the end of the book is Iowa voters have to be able to feel comfortable coming up to you and talking to you about any issue. And if they don't sense a comfort level from you as the candidate, or the voter is not comfortable going up to the candidate, then I think that suggests that your campaign is in potential trouble. You know, you still have to have certain policy stances that are appealing, and that's absolutely part of the process. But part of the process is that personal connection, and Iowans have really come to expect that.
Mm-hmm. And we can also see this. Rich mentioned Rick Santorum's different mm-hmm. stories there. We also mm-hmm. see the different stories by Hillary Clinton. In 2008, she was not as connected, not as accessible as she is this time.
Absolutely. And we've seen the change, like you said, that she's doing it this time around. And we've seen a number of candidates talking about the 99-county tour because it symbolizes a sense of you're willing to meet with Iowans in all parts of the state. It's not just going to the urban counties. It's all voters in all parts of the state matter. And that's ultimately what voters want to hear, is that I matter, right? That your interests matter to the candidate.
Mm-hmm. So we're in a way a bit spoiled here in Iowa. We get to shake hands with presidential candidates every 4 years. It seems like the campaigning never ends, actually, in Iowa. But we're spoiled, and we expect a lot of anybody who runs for political office. Very quickly, does this trickle down, did you see, into candidates, local politicians?
I didn't do anything with local levels, but I think that's absolutely a part of it. I mean, you know, door knocking remains the best method for getting out the vote, but you see that in state legislative races, that candidates are out there door knocking because they recognize how the importance of establishing a personal connection with voters.
Okay, Chris Larimer is going to stay with us, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. We were talking about his new book, Gubernatorial Stability in Iowa. When we come back, Iowa Public Radio's State House correspondent Joyce Russell will join us. Chris and Joyce will look ahead to the legislative session coming up. I believe that starts January 11th. So we want to ask you, what new legislation would you like to see in the new session? 1-866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook. Back in just a few moments. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, the 2016 Iowa legislative session, only weeks away, starting on Monday, the 11th of January. Lawmakers will gather and open their latest session. Joining us now to give us a preview of that session, what's in store in terms of new laws, also funding issues, Chris Larimer from our first half hour, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa in our Cedar Falls studio, also joined by Iowa Public Radio State House correspondent Joyce Russell in Des Moines. Hello to you, Joyce.
Hello, Ben.
So I guess we have a number of things to cover here, but education funding. Let's talk about that, since we can cast our memories back to the last session, leftover business. Remind us where we are as this session starts in terms of education funding.
Well, as you know, there was a long battle over education funding in 2015. And after, you know, almost exhausting their available options, the Republicans and Democrats came up with a compromise for some $50 million extra dollars for education that would be one-time spending. It would not be added into the base, and so it could be built upon in future years. But as you know, Governor Branstad vetoed that, and so I'm predicting that's going to linger on just psychologically in the session as they once again debate education funding.
Because this was something, this veto, unexpected or not, evidently many Democrats were caught by surprise here, and it angered the Democrats.
Well, I can't really say that it was completely unexpected. I think what was unexpected is that it was a veto that had been a bipartisan agreement. But the governor has made clear in the past that he doesn't like these one-time funding measures. So in that sense, it wasn't it was predictable. But mm-hmm. I think, as I said, because there was a hard-fought partisan agreement, that's where the surprise came in.
Mm-hmm. So when we look at the Democratic and GOP positions, education funding going forward, what would you say there? Is there more room for compromise, or will we pick up the political football again and toss it around?
Oh, it would be very unusual if there wasn't a funding battle between the Democrats and Republicans when it comes to K-12 education and beyond. I fully expect that the Democrats will come in with one position for the next school year, and Republicans will come in with another, and they'll have to work that out.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know how much you look into where this leaves Iowa school districts. Do they have clarity when it comes to funding at this point? Is that something that really needs to be provided quickly by the legislature?
Well, they have clarity for next school year, but beyond that, that's another recurring issue, and that is forward funding for K-12 schools. I should make that clear. They know what they're working with this year, but beyond that, the last several years, the legislature has been unable to agree to the kind of forward funding that the law requires and that schools favor.
Mm-hmm. Chris Larimer, what are your thoughts on the battle over education funding?
Well, I would agree with Joyce. I think what will be interesting is that psychological carryover that she mentioned. The extent to which the animosity that I think, you know, Democrats ended the session on carries over into discussions about education funding for this session. We've already seen in the lead up to the session the way that Democrats and Republicans are talking about, you know, budgetary numbers from the Revenue Estimating Conference and the way that both groups are trying to spin those numbers. And so now the question is, you know, how does the education funding play into not only education funding for school districts, but also education funding in terms of a larger issue for the 2016 elections? Is it a case where Republicans really tried to hold firm, or do Democrats really push back hard and try to use that as an issue going into the 2016 elections?
Mm-hmm. And speaking of the elections, as you know, the second year of the General Assembly is officially shorter. What you find as the session draws to a close is people being more and more anxious to get home and to campaign. So it's hard to imagine that there would be a repeat of this past year where it just went on and on and on. I don't know how that's going to be resolved. I just think it's unlikely that as they get restless and want to get home to campaign, that it's going to drag on as long as it did last year.
And Joyce, it's a 100-day target that they have for the session, isn't it, roughly?
Yes, that's right.
Yes. Okay. We want to reach out to our listeners. We have Joyce Russell and Chris Larimer here, and state politics. Lawmakers getting busy here in a couple weeks' time. We want to reach out to you and ask you, what new legislation would you like to see in the new session of the Iowa Legislature? 1-866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk. Find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook. Or you can use email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Funding, the big budget battle is also something that is going to consume a lot of time of our lawmakers. The legislature appearing to be poised for a budget battle also in this session. Joyce, is that the case?
Well, I expect a kind of similar debate to what we had last year, and it boils down to Republicans and Democrats differing on just how much ending balance they need to leave. I mean, it's indisputable, but that they will have limited extra funds to deal with. Revenues are growing, but they're not growing gangbusters. The farm economy has been depressed. Governor Branstad cannot talk about the budget without mentioning that. But there will be some extra money to spend, and there will continue to be some remaining balances that go beyond what's required by law to save, and I expect that Democrats will once again argue that it's time to spend some of those funds.
Right. We do have more revenue. It's what projected. I see $175 million in increased state revenue available for fiscal 2017, but that doesn't cover all the bases?
That is very small, actually, when you look at all of the built-in increases that there are in the budget. Medicaid alone will eat up a bunch of that, and other sort of built-in increases. So it sounds like a lot of money, but it really isn't.
Okay. 1-866-780-9100. Let's go to Sheldon. John is calling from Sheldon. Hi. What's your take on the new session? John?
Yeah, I wanted to know the guest thoughts on the IOL and actually passing a sales tax increase so we can finally fund what the voters overwhelmingly approved several years ago.
That there was I didn't quite catch what you're calling it. You say I will. Anyway, it's the extra sales tax for natural resources. Is that what you're talking about, John?
That is correct.
Okay. Well, this has been out there, a constitutional amendment a number of years ago, saying that if there is a sales tax increase, that a certain percentage of that should go into this protected fund for natural resources, and that the key thing is there is if, and there was very little appetite last year for raising the sales tax. I don't expect there will be any more appetite this year for raising the sales tax, but it is a bipartisan issue. There are Republicans and Democrats who favored this. There's a lot of public sentiment in favor of it. When this comes up at the State House, the committee rooms are jammed because a lot of people care about this. But I'm not a betting woman, but I wouldn't bet on success on that this year.
Mm-hmm. Okay, John and Sheldon, thank you very much. Let's go to Lori and calling 1-866-780-9100. Lori calling from Columbus Junction. Hi, Lori.
Hi. I was under the impression that when the lottery came into being that profits from it were supposed to go into the educational fund, and apparently this is not happening. Aren't we making money from the lottery, or where is that money going?
Great question, Lori.
Well, that has shifted over the years since the lottery was approved, and at the moment, I believe I'm correct on this, a certain portion of that goes into the general fund, and a big chunk of it goes into an infrastructure fund that pays for infrastructure projects, although that gets a little slippery, too, on what's actually called infrastructure. But there have been shifts over the years on how that lottery money, I can say for sure, does not all go to education.
Right. I think in various states, not just in Iowa, maybe, Chris, you know about this, too, but lotteries are typically sold to the public when they're instituted for things like education. And then over the years, the money that is pulled in by lotteries, I guess lawmakers look and say, hey, look at all this money coming in from the lotteries. We can pull our general fund money away from education because it's got this other revenue stream. Am I interpreting that wrong, Joyce?
I can't really speak for other states, but it's been definitely the case here, a shift in what was expected.
Mm-hmm. 1-866-780-9100. Join our conversation as we take a little preview of the 2016 legislative session, only weeks away, starting on January 11th. I was interested in this comment by Senator Chase Allen, a Democrat from Newton in the Des Moines Register. He said he didn't see anything that would derail the session, noting that lawmakers from both political parties generally agree about 90% of the bills passed, with only about 3%. And he says, where we throw bombs at each other, that's what the press reports on. So there's a little swipe at us, the press. Joyce, what can we say is common ground? Are you can you tell us things that has a lot for this session coming up, bipartisan support, things you would be surprised if in some fashion, in some shape or form, didn't pass through?
Well, a big portion of the budget is a large portion of that $7 billion budget does go through without too much controversy. And that's the biggest responsibility of the legislature in any year, election year or otherwise. That's the biggest responsibility. That's the thing they have to do before they go home. And a lot of that does go through without a lot of controversy. There will be the typical I can say there will be that 3% out there again this year. Activists have made clear that they intend to file a medical marijuana bill again. That's just one example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that. The Iowa Senate voting last Senate and last session. Let's remind ourselves, because not everyone is intimately involved with our legislature. Our Senate is in controlled by the Democrats. Very slight edge there. 26 seats in the Democrats' hands, 24 in the GOP. In the House, it's in the Republican hands by a greater margin. The 100 in the House, 57 of those go to the GOP and 43 under the Democratic umbrella. But let's talk about medical marijuana. The Senate voted last session to pass a bill that would legalize medical marijuana in certain situations. Do we look for that to have more popularity, more support this time, also among Republicans?
No, I don't. And one of the sort of sub-arguments of that are these families of severely epileptic children who 2 years ago got a bill passed to have a very limited approval for cannabis oil for these severely ill children. But even that has not really been put into rule in a way that benefits those families. I haven't heard whether we're going to specifically hear from those families again this year.
Well,
they're very well-known faces around the Capitol.
But it's also because, isn't it, Joyce, that even though it allows the medical, the cannabis oil, there's not an allowance to produce it in the state?
That's part of it. And there have been bills out there. In fact, there was a surprising vote in the direction in an interim committee last year, a surprising vote in the direction of allowing the production of medical marijuana in the state for medical purposes, and that is not going to fly, and medical marijuana is not going to fly either. It would be interesting if these families come up with some other way to tweak the law so what was intended by the legislature 2 years ago can actually benefit them. It's not just that it can't be grown in the state, but that's part of it. They have to travel to another state to get it, and they're not protected coming back with this product in their car.
Right. They have contraband coming back. Once, if they would somehow magically get it here, they are allowed to use it under certain conditions with that documentation. Chris, how do you see this view on medical marijuana? Joyce says no chance.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree. I'd be very surprised if anything happens on medical marijuana. I think when it happened in 2013, it was a complete surprise that even the medical cannabis oil was passed through. And so I'd be very surprised at this point if there was any movement on this particular issue. I think, you know, more generally though, I think what's fascinating to think about with this session is that, you know, over the last few years we've seen longer and longer sessions and fewer bills passed. But over the last couple of years, we've also had these very surprise issues pop up. We had the medical cannabis oil. We had the gas tax increase last year that didn't take as long as anybody expected it would. But then the sessions held up on education funding. So, you know, I wonder what the surprise issue is going to be this session. And then, you know, are they going to be in session for, you know, through May into June? You know, Joyce is probably right that with an election, that's not going to happen. But there does seem to be this interesting dynamic over the last 4 or 5 years in the Iowa legislature.
It is true that there's almost always a surprise issue depending on outbreaks of things in the news. But more predictably, some of the bills that got debated and not approved last year will probably be back. There will probably be a bullying bill. There will probably be a fireworks bill. And almost every year, the gun rights advocates offer something. You know, they offered a very wide-ranging bill last year, and only a relatively minor portions of that got passed. So I'd be very surprised if there wasn't another gun rights bill out there.
We haven't talked very much about economic growth in the state, legislation toward that aim. We have a worker shortage in some areas, job skill gaps. Anything to address that you anticipate, Joyce?
Well, one this is not going to depend on the legislature, but one important development for the Brandstad administration would say that this is important for economic growth. But there's a new sales tax exemption that should have gone before the legislature. The Republicans had not been able to get that through the legislature, and it's a new sales tax exemption for manufacturers. And rather than wait for the try again for the legislature, the Brandstad administration put that through in the Rules Committee, which is the critics say that's kind of a backdoor way to do that. It should have been approved by the legislature, but that went through, and so that's out there. And there's not really, there's no way that the legislature is going to reverse that. Although I'm sure many people would like to.
Okay, let's see if we can get a couple of quick calls here before the hour ends with Joyce Russell, IPR State House correspondent, and Chris Larimer, political scientist from the University of Northern Iowa. EJ is with us from Des Moines. Hi, EJ. What's on your mind when it comes to the Iowa legislature?
Hi. It's just kind of a follow-up to the discussion around K-12 funding. I think one piece that we consistently neglect to talk about is the importance of early investment, early childhood education in particular. Over the past couple legislative sessions, we've seen a few bills being introduced around expanding access for early childhood education programs. And, considering the fact that we have, 52% of every 3 and 4 is not enrolled in a pre-K program, when are we going to start prioritizing those early investments? Because, according to the Heckman equation, right, for every dollar spent on early education, we get a $7 return. So it ends up being much more cost-effective investment. So I'm, kind of interested in hearing what folks think about, what the likelihood that that could be something that we could focus in on, this coming legislative session.
That's another partisan issue that is not going to get resolved this year. Democrats in the past have offered bills to make preschool available for everyone. There's waiting lists. There are now waiting lists for preschool. It would take a big chunk of money to get rid of that waiting list and make it available to every preschool child who wants it. But that is a totally partisan issue. That's not going to go anywhere. The best they've done, last year there was a bill that kind of tinkered around the edges of early childhood education and did some things to help the schools who are trying to provide that pre-K program. Many schools have it. They're not big enough. And many schools struggle to do that because of staffing issues, because of infrastructure issues. And like I said, there was a bill passed last year to kind of help those things. But the big chunk of money they need to get rid of waiting lists for pre-K, that's not going to go anywhere.
Okay, let's try to squeeze in one more call. Sally, you're in West Des Moines. I'll have to ask you to make it very brief, but go ahead.
Hi. I'm one of the advocates for the medical cannabis, and I just wanted to let you know we're going forward. We had one of our prime advocates last year pass away from cancer before she could access. We are not giving up.
Okay. Sally in West Des Moines. So isn't that the case, Joyce? It was the surprise, the medical cannabis. We had these personal stories connected with it. What about the personal stories connected with other ailments, cancer, multiple sclerosis, Crohn's disease? You can go down. It's science documents some of them. It's going to be – but won't that have an effect as it did with that cannabis oil?
Well, and anytime there's any kind of hearing on these medical marijuana bills – the room is filled with people with these various advocating for these various patient subgroups. I think that the medical cannabis for these very fragile, very epileptic children. You said it was a surprise. It was a surprise in the end that it got passed. But those folks were such good advocates. They brought their children with them. They were better advocates. I will have to say that they were more impressive advocates, more heartrending advocates than some of the other subgroups, no matter how worthy that they are.
Okay, thank you very much. Time is up. Joyce Russell, thank you very much. Always very enlightening to have you with us, and we look forward to having you back on Mondays. to talk about the legislative session as it progresses. Again, the Iowa legislature starting up again January 11th. Iowa Public Radio State House correspondent Joyce Russell, thank you.
Okay.
Chris Larimer, thank you for being with us the entire hour. Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. We'll catch you another time, likely on a Wednesday.
Sounds good. Thanks, Ben.
Okay. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Claire Roth, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Hey, tomorrow, the top Iowa news stories of 2015. Hope you'll tune in for that. Are you thinking what they are? We hope you are. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.